Well, thank you very much. It's really nice to be here, and I'm glad we've got a bit of an audience so early in the morning. I come from the Texas Medical Center. Somebody mentioned this yesterday, that it's one of the bigger medical centers around. And we heard yesterday from somebody from the Texas Heart Institute, which is down here. I work at the Methodist Hospital, right about there in this building. I'm also affiliated with Baylor College of Medicine, which is this complex over here. And we have Rice University, you know, next door, which is a pretty good undergraduate institution. And most of these buildings are all medical buildings, either medical school buildings, hospitals, dental schools, nursing schools, all kind of in one little city all by itself. Just to give you, we have a very multidisciplinary group here, so I thought, well, I need to tell you what my background is. So I'm actually a professor of medicine, but my background is really in electrical engineering. So I have a PhD in electrical engineering. I did a postdoc fellowship in bioengineering at Rice, where we were working on artificial heart development at the time. And I've been on the faculty at Baylor since 1973. My dissertation was on ultrasonic properties of blood vessels. So I've been working in ultrasound. I've been funded by NIH to develop ultrasonic instrumentation for cardiovascular studies. So my major interest has been the assessment of cardiovascular function, diseases, and mechanics by ultrasound. So I do everything from designing the equipment to using it in the lab and trying to figure out what it all means. And so I'm going to talk to you today about some of the things related to what it all means, and we'll have some examples of some real signals that we can measure in the lab. About 15 years ago, we started using mice for most of our research because of the genetic engineering. And we wondered if we could adapt what we developed for use in patients and larger animals for use in mice. And so the idea is, could we do it non-invasively? Because we don't want our patients to go home looking like the lab rat. So why do we use mice? It's because the genomics and the genetic engineering allows us to manipulate the genome of mice. And we can study human cardiovascular diseases and conditions such as cardiac hypertrophy, atherosclerosis, hypertension, aging, and many others. But then we come into the question of how similar are their cardiovascular systems? Well, obviously, there's a huge difference in size, mouse heart, dog heart. Our heart's actually a little bigger than this dog heart. So are mice good models for human diseases? So we need to know what are the similarities and differences. Mice, of course, are much smaller. They don't live so long. They live about 3 years. And so the question is, does the size difference matter? And it does. But there are some equations that we use that relate different parameters to body weight. These were all, this was all done in a book that I found a few years ago on engineering design of the cardiovascular system of mammals. Being an engineer, I like this engineering design principle thing. He based all these equations on cell metabolism, diffusion distances, and times and energy transport. So it's really all based on the efficient transport of substances from the bloodstream into cells and out, to generation of heat and metabolism, utilization of oxygen. And we ended up with some fairly interesting relationships. If you look at the power, so basically you've got your parameter here is proportional. Constant times body weight raised to some power. And it's this power law that gets interesting. Things that relate to weight and volume tend to scale directly proportional to body weight. So the bigger you are, the bigger your heart is, and the bigger your stroke volume. Heart rate scales to the minus one-fourth power of body weight. So the bigger you are, the lower your heart rate. Cardiac output scales to the three-fourths power of body weight. And the reason this occurs is, cardiac output, stroke volume times heart rate. So if you add these exponents, you get 3/4. So that's why that relationship works out that way. It seems like kind of an odd number. Aortic diameter scales to body weight with 3/8 power, another sort of an odd number. You would think that if the vascular system was just bigger, everything would scale, the linear dimensions would scale to 1/3 power, but they don't. Diameter scales to 3/8. The length scales to the 1/4. So if you take aortic diameter, if you do the area, it goes to 3/4. Length to 1/4. You add those up and you get 1. So blood volume's the same. So the volume of your arterial system is the same, but the proportions change a little different. Some things don't scale. Blood pressure is the same in mice and people and elephants. Blood velocities are the same. You measure them in centimeters per second. Pulse wave velocity, that is how fast the pulses travel down the arteries, which is an index of compliance, is the same. A couple things of interest to modelers is the entrance length, which is how long does it take for the blunt flow that the heart develops to become parabolic. In humans, they consider it to be 10 or 20 diameters, so they measure it in distances. So it's like 20 centimeters, 30 centimeters from the heart before it gets parabolic. In mice, it's about a millimeter. So their flow becomes laminar, very close to the heart. Lifespan, mouse is about 3 years. It's interesting, humans fit all these formulas except lifespan. If you plug in human weights for lifespan, you get 22 years. So we live a lot longer than we're supposed to based on our design. You know, maybe we've adapted better than the rest of the creatures. Well, let's look at some of the reality. So here's some actual numbers. Some of these are really old. You know, these are from publications back in the 30s and 40s. This is heat production. And again, this scales to the 3/4 power because it's related to cardiac output. So here's mice and here's elephants. It's plotted on a log-log scale, so these become straight lines. And they actually fit these equations quite well. Oxygen consumption, again, it goes to the 3/4 power. Heart rate, to the -1/4 power. So these things all tend to fit with the reality, but they're really based on some very basic principles. So what do we want to measure? We'd like to measure everything we can. Blood pressure, we want to measure flow and velocity, dimensions, the arteries, how they pulsate, function of the heart, impedance, reflections, stiffness of vessels. All of these tend to be functions of time. That is, as the heart pulses, these things change with time. So our challenge is to be non-invasive, first of all, and to have very high spatial and temporal resolution. So the heart rate's fast. Vessels are small, so we need really good resolution. So if we look at the methods that are normally used to measure pressures, flows, and dimensions, you know, most of them are invasive. We can measure pressure by a tail cuff, which is kind of similar to what we do with an arm cuff on people, but we use the tail in mice because it's easier to get to. So that's one of the non-invasive methods we can use. And then there are some various methods based on ultrasound, some of which are non-invasive that we can use to measure blood flow and dimensions and do some imaging and follow motion. So I'll talk about mostly these non-invasive things. So this is our lab where we do non-invasive echocardiography and ultrasound in mice. So this is our cardiac echo lab. And you know, my engineering background, we designed most of this equipment that we use. This is one of our technicians, Tweet Pam, and she's an expert in our mouse sonographer. So she's measuring aortic blood flow in this mouse by holding a probe up to his chest right below the sternum, pointing it up toward the aortic valve in his heart. So we anesthetize mice by putting them in a chamber with gas, and so this guy's falling asleep. We then take them out, we put them on this board. The board actually contains electrodes so that we can get an EKG from the limb leads. We hold them down with tape or rubber bands, very sophisticated. And so here's an EKG on the scope, and here's the aortic flow pattern done with the Doppler. So this is the kind of signals we generate. So what we do is we send in a pulse of sound at a high frequency, in this case 10 megahertz. It gets reflected off the things in the path. And if things don't move, the reflection, the frequency of the reflections is the same as what we send out. But if things move, like blood cells and tissue in the heart, we get a Doppler shift that's dependent on the velocity. So what we measure here is the frequency of the Doppler shift, and we can then use that to calculate blood velocity. So what we see here is flow coming out of the heart. So here's the EKG, P wave, QRS complex. So after the QRS complex, the heart squeezes, ejects blood. So here's opening of the aortic valve and closing of the aortic valve. And the heart's ejecting during this time. Then the heart relaxes and it fills. So here's flow coming into the heart in the other direction through the mitral valve. So the atria is now full of blood. When the heart relaxes and the pressure gets down below the atrial pressure, flow rushes in. So we get this early wave of filling. Then the flow pretty well you know, when all the blood runs out, blood velocity goes down. Then the atria contracts, and we get this extra wave we fill in, which is the A wave, atrial wave. Then the heart contracts again, we get another R wave, we get another injection. Now, these signals look very similar to what we see in people. In fact, the velocities are the same, and even the timing looks the same. In fact, all of these numbers that we use to indicate ventricular function, this E wave and A wave, are derived from human data. So they're the same ones the cardiologists use to analyze people. We measure acceleration, which is a sort of an index of the amount of energy imparted to the blood to accelerate it from standing start to, in this case, about 90 centimeters. Peak velocity, we can measure the area under the curve, which is related to stroke volume. We can measure the average velocity, which is related to cardiac output. But again, the numbers are very similar to what we see in people. We can also do the same thing in smaller vessels. So here's signals from a carotid artery. We've taken our probe and we aim it at the carotid artery here, and our sample volume is the area that we're sensitive to. And so we've got a blood vessel here with a velocity profile. And in this case, our sample volume is a little bigger than the vessel. So this is about a half millimeter in diameter, carotid artery. Our sample volume is slightly bigger than that. And what we see on the screen, again, is the frequency here, velocity here, calculated from the Doppler equation, which is here. F naught is our transmit frequency, which in this case is 20 megahertz. Velocity is velocity of the blood cell, C is speed of sound, and then the angle, the cosine of the angle between our sound beam and the flow axis. So if you work out the constants, if the angle was close to zero, this is the relationship between velocity and kilohertz. Now, this is a spectrum. And so basically, each red cell contributes a little bit of energy to the spectrum based on its velocity. Since all velocities aren't the same, they range from zero at the wall to a peak in the middle, you get a distribution of frequencies. And it's relatively flat. And if we listen to it, you can hear this sound, and it sounds kind of like white noise. You know, there's no real characteristic frequency in there, it's just kind of a hiss. And that's because the spectrum is very broad. And you can see that in a wave, that the energy or the intensity in here is pretty uniformly distributed, all the way from zero up to the peak. At the peak, it drops off quickly. So you get a very defined outline of peak velocity. But the intensity gives you a little bit of information about what the velocity profile is. Now, if we compare it to humans, and again, my human subject is usually me, so you're going to see some of my data in here too occasionally. So here's a carotid velocity pattern for me. You'll notice the velocities are pretty similar. You know, I'm peaking at 65 or 70, and so is the mass. Shape of the wave is pretty similar. Peak, there's kind of a flat spot, a dip, and there's quite a bit of flow during diastole. Now, the flow coming out of the heart comes out in a spurt, and it stops when the heart quits beating. And yet, when you get out of the periphery, there's flow during diastole, even though the heart isn't pumping anymore. And that's because of the energy storage in the system. Other thing to notice here is that because my vessel's pretty big and our sample volume's the same size, now the sample volume's pretty small compared to the vessel. And we can now see that the intensity is concentrated at the high end of the spectrum. And that's because we're sampling mostly at the middle of the vessel. So we've got a kind of a dark spot here, and there's less energy here. So the width of the spectrum is related to the size of the sample volume and the velocity profile. And so they interact in ways. This could also be narrow if my profile was blunter than it was in the mouse. And it might be. But we get information about the velocity distribution from the spectrum. What about other vessels? Well, we can measure flow in most of the large vessels in the mouse, you know, non-invasively with a probe that looks like this. These probes are about a millimeter and a half in diameter, and they're focused. There's a concave surface on the front of the transducer, which tends to focus the beam. And the idea is to try to keep the sample volume small enough that we only get signals from the vessel. So we can get signals from the aorta, renal arteries, celiac arteries. You'll notice that the flow coming out of the heart is basically zero during diastole. But we When you get down to the peripheral vessels, there's quite a bit of flow during the diastole. And again, the velocities and the magnitudes are very similar to what the same signals you see in people. Now, if we look at the timing, we can see that flow starts out of the heart here, but it takes a while before flow starts up in the renal artery or in the carotid. In fact, most of these vessels start up fairly late compared to that. So that's because the pulse wave velocity is finite. It takes a while for the pulses to translate down the vessel. And so that gives us a way to measure something related to compliance. So what we do in mice is we take a measurement at the aortic arch and another measurement down here, about 40 millimeters apart. We time them with the EKG, and we look at how long it takes a pulse that starts in the aorta to get down to the bottom. Now, these are related to the elastic modulus. So this is pulse wave velocity. This is modulus of lacticity, wall thickness, vessel diameter, and density of blood. And to put this in perspective, you know, what do you think happens here? If flow starts in at one end of this segment of vessel before it starts out, it means that we're expanding the vessel. So we've got about 12 milliseconds here where flow's going in and nothing's coming out. And so during that time, the vessel's expanding. And the amount that it expands is related to the compliance and the elastic modulus. And that's why this pulse wave velocity is related to the expansion. So the longer the time delay, the more blood can come in before it starts out, and the lower the pulse wave velocity. And so that's how they're related. If you actually take the numbers, we got 40 millimeters and 12 milliseconds, so we get a pulse wave velocity in this mouse of 3.2 millimeters per millisecond, or 3.2 meters per second. And again, that's very close to what the numbers are in people. So if we look at a bunch of mice, here's some normal mice, pulse wave velocity, average is about 4.6 meters per second. Smooth muscle actin knockout mice have a protein missing in their vessel wall, and they have very little vascular tone, and their vessels are quite floppy, and their pulse wave velocity is lower. The matrix glob protein knockout mice have calcified vessels. They're stiff, and their pulse wave velocity is higher. So again, we can measure this non-invasively in a mouse. Good index of vascular stiffness. Now, if you administer a vasoconstrictor, you would expect the vessels to get stiffer. And so if we give phenylephrine to normal mice, we can increase pulse wave velocity more than twice. The smooth muscle actin knockout mice, which are missing that protein, they don't respond to phenylephrine much at all. So the response is quite blunted in these animals. But again, we now have an index of vascular stiffness that we can use to separate out the genetics of these mice. Again, values and responses are very similar to what we get in people. Even the magnitudes are the same. What about blood pressure? The problem with mice, their vessels are really little. And almost anything you do to measure blood pressure dampens the signal, and you can't get good fidelity. So one of the ways to get a waveform is to actually press a pressure transducer against the outside of the vessel. If you flatten the wall a little bit, the pressure inside gets transferred to transducer, and you can measure a pretty good waveform of pressure. And so here's a waveform of pressure and velocity in a mouse carotid artery. And the fidelity is high enough we can do derivatives for pressure and derivatives for velocity and time them with EKG, so we get a lot of information about the timing. Problem is, it's still invasive. We have to open them up and put the transducer against the wall of the vessel. So even though we're not opening the vessel, we have to expose it. So that's a problem. So the question is, can we generate a pressure waveform non-invasively? And if you look at vessels, this is an image of a carotid artery in a mouse. So this is a millimeter scale. So diameter is about half a millimeter. But it pulsates. When the pressure pulses come through, the walls move. And so the question is, can we measure the waveform of these diameter pulsations during the cardiac cycle? It generates something that looks like a pressure wave. And so if we take our Doppler probe, our ultrasound probe, and put it on the skin, and we aim it at a blood vessel, we normally put our sample volume in the middle of the vessel, and we look at blood velocity. But when it's centered like this, the sound beam also goes through the walls. So on the way in, it goes through the wall. and on the way out, it goes through this wall, and these walls move. So if we analyze those signals, we can actually get a waveform of the wall motion of the near wall and the far wall. If we subtract them, we can get the diameter change. These are all done with one probe, so we're using the same signal. We just process it a little differently to get wall motion versus blood velocity. For wall motion, we're really looking at the phase of the echoes. For velocity, we're looking at the derivative of a phase, which is frequency. And so we actually are processing signals the same way. What we're doing is we're just sampling at different places. We normally sample our echoes after the sound goes out and back, you know, whenever the time delay relates to distance for blood flow. But if we sample a little bit earlier, a little bit later, we get these walls. The scale's here in microns, so the total wall motion here is about 40 microns, roughly 10% of the diameter, about what it is in people. Now, when you're measuring motion at 40 microns, it's really hard to hold your probe really still. So again, we have this sophisticated device to hold the probe against the mouse on our board. But it works quite well. We can get really pretty good stability that way. And again, this is coupling gel. We're just sending a sound beam in, you know, through the skin and his neck to get the carotid artery signal. So here's some waveforms from some different vessels. So we get, this is the abdominal aorta, the carotid artery, iliac artery. They're done at different times, but I've lined up the R waves on this first beat so you can see the timing. So the pulsation starts first in the carotid artery and then in the descending aorta. So it starts earlier here, a little bit later in the descending aorta, even later in the iliac, which is going down toward the legs. And again, this is 40 microns. So the abdominal aorta pulsates the most, about 110 microns. The carotid, a little bit less. And the iliac, a little bit less. All these vessels pulsate about 10% of their diameter. It's relatively consistent in terms of, so that means that their elastic modulus and their wall thickness and diameters are pretty similar. Other thing is the waveforms tend to dampen with distance. So the closer you are to the heart, the sharper the waves are. So you get a very sharp upstroke in the carotid. It's a little smoother in the aorta and even smoother yet in the iliac. So the pressure waves tend to dampen. They lose their high frequency content with distance, and that's what we expect. Again, they really resemble pressure waves. So let's look at some diameter signals from different types of mice. You know, WT means wild type, which is our, you know, word for normal. So these are the normal mice. These are old mice. You know, again, they pulsate a little bit more than the normal ones, but there's some differences in the shapes of these waves. The smooth muscle actin knockout mice are the ones with the missing protein. They pulsate a lot. So they're about 100 microns. And ApoE knockout mice have atherosclerosis. So their vessels are stiffer. They got plaques, and they don't pulsate as much. And again, these all resemble pressure waves. So how good is the resolution? So I'm going to take this wave, and I'm going to blow it up. And if I do that, it gets really big. But we still see all this detail. So this is now 1 micron. So we actually have a resolution of approximately 1/10 of a micron in terms of following the motion of the wall. And this is something that nobody really thought we could do because the wavelength that we're using is about 80 microns. We're actually getting resolution that's quite a bit smaller than wavelength, but that's just because we can follow motion better than we can locate a structure. So it's the change in position that we can do quite accurately. Again, just for perspective, here's the diameter of a mouse red blood cell. So we're measuring the motion that's quite a bit smaller than the diameter of their cells. What about inflections? Can we do anything about that? Is there any information in these little bumps we see in the waves? There's a little bump here, there's a little bump here in the dicrotic notch. Well, in people, the doctors look at an inflection on this rising of pressure. And so we're kind of assuming the diameter looks like a pressure wave. But they actually do this inflection point, and they call this an augmentation index. And the way they define it is they take the derivative of pressure. So we're taking derivative of wall motion, which is velocity in our case. So where our peak velocity of the wall is about 3 millimeters per second, it's pulsing up. We look for a local minimum in the derivative when it's still positive on the upstroke. And we mark that point as the inflection point. And the augmentation index is really this distance divided by the total pulsation. And the delta D is just the max minus the min. In humans, that tends to increase with age, and it increases with vascular disease. And it's thought to be an index of the early return of reflected waves. Because if the pulse wave velocity goes up, those waves come back sooner. And it's thought to be bad if they come back during the upslope of pressure because they increase the load on the heart. And so it's something we try to avoid. Now, if we look at all our groups of mice, we've got wild types and apoes and smooth muscle actin knockouts and just old mice. So the normal mice tend to group here. And what I've plotted is augmentation index on one axis and the total diameter pulsation on the other. So these are a couple of the indices we can look at. So the normal mice are grouping here. The atherosclerotic mice are grouping here. So they have low pulsations, high augmentation index. They have disease. Old mice have kind of normal pulsations but a high augmentation index, just like people do. Smooth muscle actin mice have high pulsations and kind of a normal augmentation index, maybe a little above normal. So let's look at how this works. Why do velocity waves, like in the aorta and the carotid artery, look different? Now, why is there no flow during systole here and or diastole here and there's flow here? And then why do velocity waves and pressure waves look different? I mean, velocity is driven by pressure. Why do they look different? And it's because we've got pulse transmission and reflection, and we've got compliant tubes, and these really complicate things. So if we start out and just inject a little pulse of blood into an artery, it moves its way down to the end. When it gets to the end, it gets reflected and comes back. And so, and the speed of transmission is the pulse wave velocity, like we looked at before. So pulse wave velocity is a function of stiffness and geometry. It's faster in hard vessels, slower in floppy ones. And the interaction of the forward and the backward waves generates the shape of the measured pressure and flow waves at each side. And because the waves distort and meet at different times, the shapes of measured pressure and flow waves is a function of position. So they're not the same everywhere. And they're related mostly to these wave reflections. In arteries, the speed is fast enough and ejection takes long enough that reflections start to arrive at the heart before the end of ejection. So it isn't just this little bolus. If you look at it for real, the heart starts ejecting, and it takes a little while, and the pulses are going to the end, they start coming back even before the heart's finished ejecting. So if you look at the forward wave at this position, it might look like this. A little bit later, we see the backward wave. Trouble is, we can't measure these. What we measure is the sum. So it looks like this. And so the idea being, this little bump we see in this upward wave, which we tried to measure as an inflection coefficient, is really related to the return of reflected waves. That's what makes this little bump. And again, I've just kind of moved the forward and backward wave up here. The flow wave is really the difference between the forward and backward wave. So it's this area in here that generates flow. Because the backward wave inhibits flow. It adds to pressure, but it subtracts from flow. So if there were only forward waves, pressure, diameter, flow, and velocity, they all start up at the same time, and they have similar shapes until reflected wave arrives. So, you know, flow and pressure are related by the characteristic impedance of the vessel in the forward wave. Backward wave, actually, they're related the same way, except that since the wave's coming backwards, the flow is negative. The backward flow wave is reversed. So, the pressure wave is the sum of the forward and backward waves. The flow wave is the difference divided by the characteristic impedance. But because we can measure these, we can rearrange these equations and actually calculate forward and backward waves from the measured pressure and flow waves if we know the characteristic impedance, which we can estimate by looking at the derivatives of flow and pressure on the upslope before reflected waves have started to come back. So let's see what we can do. Now, we can't measure flow and pressure. We measure velocity and diameter. But since pressure and diameter waves look very similar, and flow and velocity waves look very similar. We can actually do these calculations on the things that we can measure non-invasively. So this is now based on diameter. So the diameter wave we measure against is the sum of the forward and backward waves. And the velocity is the difference, and so we can calculate these waves from these differences. And we can also calculate characteristic impedance, but now it's in kind of funny units because we've got diameter and velocity. Now, there's various folks who've looked at doing this in people, and they actually measure diameter waves, and they calibrate them for pressure based on what you measure with a pressure cuff. So they'll say, okay, that's systolic, and maybe that's 120, and maybe that's 80. They actually put pressure numbers to these waves. And then they quite often just leave velocity alone because, again, it doesn't scale with body size. So you can use velocity numbers and not have to deal with size. But again, you can generate forward and backward waves. Now, we've just been talking about the fact that the little bump in this wave is caused by the reflection. And yet, if you look at this wave, there's two humps in the forward wave. And so why does that happen? That we puzzled about this for quite a while until we finally figured out that the forward and backward wave are only related to this carotid artery we're measuring. So all we're measuring is reflections from up here coming back. We're ignoring all the rest of it. Now, the thing is, all the rest of the reflections come back, and they go forward in the carotid artery. And so the second bump here is really the reflections from the descending aorta and all the rest of the body that have come back to the heart, and now they're going forward in the carotid. So the two bumps are here. And so that's why there's two peaks in this forward wave. Now, people aren't used to doing this in man. So again, I use myself, and here's my subject. So with the tonometer, I can get a pressure wave from my carotid artery just by pushing it up against the vessel in a velocity wave. And I can calculate my forward and backward wave, and sure enough, I see two peaks in the forward wave. Looks just like the ones in mice. Very similar. So a lot of the stuff that we can measure in mice really does carry over to people in a meaningful way. We just have to keep track of how we're doing this. Now, actually, this picture I took at a museum where they were showing this Body Worlds exhibit, but it's a really good picture of coronary arteries. Now, coronary arteries, we talked about yesterday, is one of the more important circulations because it's the one that gets compromised a lot by stenoses and problems in the vessels. So, can we do that in mice? Now, in people, and this is a cast of coronaries from a dog, this is an arteriogram made by injecting contrast dye into a human coronary artery. And basically what happens is humans quite often get these blockages, or partial blockages. And so the question is, what does this do to blood flow? Obviously it doesn't stop flow, otherwise you wouldn't be able to see the vessel down here. And it turns out that even a very severe lesion like this doesn't do much to blood flow, at least at rest. Because when you have a stenosis here, which is causing, you know, kind of a tight resistance, the vessels down here open up. And what they do is they try to keep the total resistance constant to maintain perfusion. If it didn't happen, you know, you'd end up with problems at rest. So we, you know, many years ago developed some catheters that we could put in people to look at coronary blood flow. And the problem is that resting flow is often normal. And so, you know, what's the use of measuring flow? And so we developed some other methods to look at how much can flow go up when you vasodilate. So what we do here is we're measuring blood flow. This is velocity at rest. And the speed of the paper, these are 1 second marks here. So here's diastole, here's systole. We then slowed down the paper speed. We made an injection of contrast agent. This is what was approved for humans. And that's what we used to make an arteriogram. So it's the stuff that shows up on the x-ray. It also vasodilates. So when you squirt it in, you can measure the squirt comes out through our sensor. Flow goes down a little bit, and then it overshoots, comes back up. And so if we filter out the heart rate, which is what's shown here, we can measure the hyperemic or the peak velocity in the baseline. And if we do a ratio, this guy goes up about a factor of 3 in this patient. That's pretty normal. If you have disease, so now we're looking at this hyperemic to baseline ratio versus percent stenosis. So the more stenosis you have, the lower this reserve. So what happens is at rest, these vessels are dilating to maintain resting flow. And if they're already dilated, they don't have so far to go to get to maximum. So this is an index of the severity of the stenosis that we can measure non-invasively. So can we do this in mice? Well, problem in mice, of course, is the coronaries are really little. They're about 200 microns. They're close to all kinds of other vessels. They move. They're attached to the heart. It beats. And we really didn't think we could do it. But you know, the idea is if we could put a Doppler probe, you know, and aim it at the left main coronary artery, and here's a probe and a holder. We have a little more sophisticated holder now for this, because we have to really adjust this carefully. Because everything moves and everything beats. So we have these, you know, X, Y, and Z positioners that we can use to get signals. And we can generate signals that look like this. And the question is this coronary flow? And how do we tell? With all the other stuff moving around the heart. So here's some signals from what we think is coronary flow and from the aorta and the carotid artery, all done at the same time in a mouse. It's really hard to do this in people. But mice, there's a lot of things you can do in mice turn out to be a lot easier. And we were really surprised with some of this. But if we look at the timing again, here's aortic ejection. A little bit later, there's carotid ejection. And really later, there's coronary. So, you know, why does coronary flow start up so late? It's right by the heart. It ought to come up right now. And the reason is when the heart contracts, eject blood, it shuts off its own blood supply. And you can't run blood into a vessel that's constricted, because we're generating aortic pressure within this meat or your muscle, and it shuts off blood flow. So it's the external forces on the blood vessels really collapse them. So really, we're shutting off flow during systole. And so we don't get flow to right here when the heart relaxes and all the blood stops coming in and the heart's relaxing is when flow starts up in the coronary artery. It starts up here. It actually reaches a peak when the pressure in the ventricle gets down to a minimum. Which, you know, so this is kind of a measure of how long it takes the heart to relax. It goes from here to here. And then it decays, which is what happens to pressure during diastole. So, you know, we can get a lot of information on all these signals. The flow waveform at the heart is really dominated by the cardiac ejection. It squeezes blood. There's not much component of reflected waves here in terms of what flow is. It just stops coming out. In the carotid, we've got this extra flow during diastole, and that's because of wave reflections and because of the energy storage capacity of all these compliant vessels that are in the body, the aorta. And in the coronaries, we're also driven by aortic pressure, but it's modulated by changing impedance. So during the cardiac cycle, we're actually changing the resistance of these vessels periodically with the heart. So it makes it very complicated to model coronary circulation, because you got an inlet pressure that looks like aortic pressure, but you're also modulating the impedance downstream. And you're really shutting off flow during the time the pressure is the highest. So we can make these measurements, but how do we measure hyperemic velocity? That is, how do we dilate coronary arteries in a mouse? It's really hard to inject things. In people, they use adenosine, which is a coronary vasodilator, and they use it clinically to increase flow in patients to diagnose heart disease. And we started doing studies in mice to figure out, you know, how do we use adenosine? How do we adjust the dose? How do we get it in? And while we were doing it, we found out that the anesthesia we were using, you know, would make blood flow go up and down quite a lot. And we finally figured out that if we use a low level of isoflurane versus a high level, we can make coronary flow go up quite a lot just by changing the gas. It's almost like a faucet. You want flow to go up, you crank up the gas a little bit, it goes up. And in this one, it went up about 2.2. It actually, most mice goes up even more than that. Again, we're looking at velocities here of maybe, you know, 35 or 40 centimeters per second at the peak, and up here they're getting close to 75. So we're getting, and these are very similar to what we get in people. Even the waveforms look the same. They're primarily diastolic, a little bit of systolic, but not much. So what happens in old mice and ApoE mice, different ages? So what I'm showing here is a graph, and this is baseline velocity, and this is the resting velocity, and it's really the peak of during diastole. And the hyperemic is the highest velocity we can get. And then the ratio is this hyperemic over baseline, which in people it was about 3. And so is it in mice. So here's our numbers for H over P, and they're kind of grouping there. The young mice have a ratio of 2.4. These are 6 week old. 3 months old are adults. You know, 3.0. 2 year old are getting senescent, so they're like maybe a 60 year old human. And it's even a little bit higher. In humans, this tends to go down, but it's probably because humans, by this age, start getting vascular disease, and mice don't get this. The 2 year old ApoE mice have atherosclerosis. And we thought, okay, these guys may have coronary disease. Let's look at their flow reserve. And it actually goes down a little bit compared to these, which are their age-matched controls. The other thing that happens, we saw big increases in baseline velocity. It's more than twice normal. And big increases in the hyperemic velocity. And again, you've got to kind of think about the situation here. You've got a vessel with disease, it's stenosed. So if you've got a stenosis right where you're measuring, the velocity goes up a little bit. And so we think that a lot of these mice have disease in their left main, and it's increasing their velocity, even at rest, because of we're encroaching on the lumen. We can still vasodilate. In fact, we can get velocities that are huge. The highest we've seen is about 360 centimeters per second in a corner, just huge. The flow reserve is down a little bit, but not by much. And so these guys have lesions which probably don't affect their flow reserve. They're probably no more than 25% by diameter, maybe 50% by area. And they don't really affect flow reserve very much. They lower it a little bit, and there's actually quite a large variance in that number. So what about other forms of heart and vascular disease? One of the models we use in our lab is to put a band on the aorta between the origin and the two carotid arteries. And we do that because it creates pressure overload hypertrophy. We use this to study remodeling of the heart with some of the genetic models. It basically creates a hypertension sort of model. At least the heart sees high blood pressure. But it also affects the arterial system. So if you look at the left and right carotid arteries, which are here, and this is just paper behind them so you can see the vessels better. Right carotid artery, which sees high pressure, expands. And it's about twice the diameter of the left. This is after a couple weeks of this banding model. So a lot of things happen in addition to the heart getting bigger. And so what does it do to carotid flows? So this shows some signals that we measured. Here's where our band is. And so we measured flow in the right carotid and left carotid. So right carotid artery is now much more pulsable than it was in normal animals. In normal animals, there's always a baseline here. Here now we get a big spurt, and then it reverses. And it actually ends up close to zero before the next beat happens. If we look at the pattern in the left carotid artery, which is on the far side of this stenosis, it's very much uniform. It's almost steady, not quite. Pulses a little bit, but not much. And the velocities are quite a bit lower. Here the peaks are about 160. Here they're about 15. So big differences. If we look at the velocity at the jet, right beyond the stenosis, it's very high. We get peaks of around 500 centimeters per second. If we calculate pressure drop, it's roughly 75 millimeters of mercury in this muscle. Big pressure drop across a stenosis like this. And very much different, it really changes the velocity patterns on both sides significantly. It's something to consider when you model the arterial system. You really have to keep in mind not only what your intervention does, but how the body responds to it. Because the body does everything it can to maintain flow. So these mice actually live for quite a long time with this, even with all this problems. So what happens to coronary flow? So here's coronary flow before and after isoflurane, and this is before we did the band. And this is one day after the band. And again, we still see we're getting flow reserve. But if we wait for 21 days, 3 weeks later, the resting flow and hyperemic flow are about the same. Other thing that happens, and we still don't fully understand this, is that we now get a lot of flow during systole. which we never got before. And so we find, you know, when we vasodilate with our isoflurane, we sometimes see an increase in the systolic heart flow. We never quite understood why that happened, but somehow in these mice after 21 days of hypertrophy, doesn't happen immediately. These guys still have the pressure drop. But when the heart responds and it remodels, we end up getting more systolic flow. If you look at flow reserve, here's just the H over B ratio. It's about 3.2 before banding, and it goes down to 1.1. Basically goes away after 3 weeks. And this is just before these animals go into heart failure. So we think this flow reserve is an index that kind of predicts when heart failure might start. Because when flow reserve goes down to one, that is, you can't increase flow during rest, if whatever is causing this reduction keeps going, now you're starting to decrease resting flow. And that's really when you start getting into real problems in the heart. But the systolic-diastolic ratio is another thing that we didn't expect. We expected flow reserve to go down. But it's going down here because, it's not because of coronary disease, it's because we're increasing resting flow. When you have coronary disease, your resting flow is normal, and what you're decreasing is your peak. And here we're increasing resting flow until it comes up to peak, and then your reserve goes away. But the way it does it is, it seems like it does it by increasing flow during systole, and it's kind of wondering, well, how can this happen? If the heart's squeezing itself and shutting off its flow, how can we get so much flow during systole? And so our hypothesis now is that the hypertrophy is happening in areas of the heart that aren't generating as much pressure as the rest of it. Because if they generate, you know, less pressure, you can actually get flow during systole. If it's really contributing to pressure generation, it shouldn't be getting flow.
Sorry, one quick interruption, but we need its velocity.
It's velocity.
Not flow. So
that's true.
We're not sure whether it is flow.
Well, we're pretty sure that it's, I mean, since it's velocity, what happens is we expect that the diameter of these vessels, in fact, we've actually done some analysis of this, the diameters of the vessels get a little bigger here. But this ratio is pretty similar. We still see, I mean, the diameter may be a little bigger during systole because it pulsates a little bit. So there's a little bit of modulation, but it's, we've kind of looked at that and tried to figure out how much difference would it make. And it might make maybe 10% if it pulsates 10%. You know, but between this peak and this peak. But still, it's still a lot bigger than we expect it to be. If we look at humans, the signals that we get here look like right coronary signals. So here's signals from the left coronary artery of a patient. Again, this is with our catheter, and these are in the same patient. So the left coronary, you get a little bit of systolic flow, a lot of diastolic flow, unlike what we see in these mice normally. Right coronary artery, because it supplies right ventricle and right atrium, which generate less pressure, can get more flow during systole. And so the signals we see now in the left coronary of the mice look like right coronary people. Again, we're not quite sure why this happens. This patient had normal coronaries. He came in for diagnosis of disease because he had chest pain, but we didn't find there were no problems with the coronaries, at least on the arteriograms. So again, let's go back and look at our at some of our scaling relations. And so I put a few more things up here now. So again, things that scale to the first power are weights and volumes. Heart rate goes to the -1/4 power. Heart period goes to the +1/4 power, so it's just the inverse. Circulation time, that is, how long does it take blood to, you know, take one circuit through the body? And again, it's proportional to the heart period. Lifespan, artery length is also proportional to heart period. So the bottom line is if you've got, since velocity is the same, a pulse tends to go about as far down the vessel in terms of the percent way during the cardiac cycle. In big versus little animals. And that has implications in the time constant. So the time constant of the arterial system is scaled to the period of the heart. And this is what makes the waveforms look the same. Because the reflection times are again scaled to heart period, the compliance and the time constants are too. again, length, diameter scales to 3/8 power. Wall shear stress scales to the minus 3/8 power. That's a lot higher in a mouse. But if you're doing modeling where shear stress matters, mice have shear stresses that are maybe 20 times as high as ours in a given vessel, since the diameters are about 20th and the velocities are the same. Entrance length is a lot shorter in a mouse, so that's something else to consider. Accelerations like dpdt, the derivative of pressure, and the acceleration of the aorta tend to go to the minus 1/4 power, since they go to the same magnitude, but they have to do it in a much shorter time. Capillary diameter. Here's some other interesting numbers, and these just have some odd things. The capillary diameter goes to the 12th power of body weight. So mice have a little bit smaller capillary diameter than we do, but it's only about a factor of 2. Capillary length, you know, these are based on how long, you know, it's based on diffusion time. So the blood cell has to spend a certain amount of time in the capillary to get all its oxygen out. And so these lengths are based on the velocities that are measured. And again, this is all done from theory, but it turns out to work reasonably well. Number of capillaries scales to the 5/8 power. It actually scales to the same power that the cell number does, the number of body cells. Cell length scales to the 8th power. So our cells are a little bigger than mouse cells. But if you look at volume of this is 3/8, and the number is 5/8, you add them up, you get 1. Total mass of cells is the same. They're just, you know, a little different configuration. Plastic modulus, same in us, big and little. Blood viscosity is about the same because the hematocrit is similar. Blood velocity, pulse wave velocity, the diameter pulsations, again, they're pretty much similar. Coronary reserve, which we found is pretty similar in mice. Now, we think, and we don't really know, and this is sort of a speculation about red cell diameter. It would make sense that the red cell diameter would be similar to the capillary diameter, because they have to be crammed through these capillaries. The capillaries are generally smaller than red cells. They have to deform to fit through there. But it turns out when you actually do numbers on red cell diameter for different animals, they're all over the place. So they don't vary a lot, but they don't necessarily go up with the animal size like you would think they would. So it may have to do with deformability in addition to the size of their capillaries. And let's look at some of the numbers. And here I've just taken a few of these. Assume that we have a 70 kilogram human and a 25 gram mouse. So their body sizes are about 2,800 in terms of ratio. Okay, yeah, I'm done. This is one of my last years. So if we look at cardiac output, goes to the 3/4 power. And this is just kind of what the ratio would be for these various power laws. There's 385 cell number, vessel diameter, factor 20 in mice. If it's just linear dimensions, which turns out not much scales to linear dimensions like you think, would be factor 14. Vessel length, about 7. And the period of the heart, about 7. So their heart rate is about 7 times as fast as ours. Length of cells, capillary diameter, about twice as high. Humans to mice. Blood pressure and velocities tend to not scale at all. Capillary velocity is actually a little higher in a mouse. It has to do with how they scale, but not by much. 1/24th power, so it's pretty close to zero, but not quite. Accelerations and heart rate, you know, go up. It's basically the inverse of 7 for those. So, conclusion. Blood velocity signals from the heart and most vessels, arteries and mice can be obtained non-invasively. We can also get arterial displacement signals at the same time non-invasively. Pulse wave velocity, augmentation index, percent diameter change in coronary reserve can be determined from velocity and displacement signals. And sometimes their responses to vasoactive agents. So blood velocity, blood pressure, pulse wave velocity, percent wall displacement in mice and humans are similar. Both magnitude and shape. The arterial time constants are scaled to heart periods, such as reflections return to the heart at similar times during the cardiac cycle. This is what makes the waveforms look similar. And many of the things we can measure in mice and men are altered by age and disease in similar ways. And again, this is the credits to collaborators. This is a very interdisciplinary kind of research that we do. So we've got cardiologists, physiologists, gerontologists, bioengineers, and we all work together. So thank you very much.